At least 4% of all defendants sentenced to death in the United States between the years 1973 and 2004 were innocent of the crimes for which they were convicted. The same 2014 National Academy of Sciences study researchers believe that the rate of innocence must be higher still for those guilty of murder, but not given a death sentence. Does Philadelphia resident LaFay Gaskins, now serving life without parole, fall into that category? Investigative reporter Dan Denver spent 2 years looking into Gaskins' case and joins me now on Newsworks Tonight. Dan, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
This story appears in Philadelphia magazine. What first drew you to Gaskins' case?
Well, about 2 years ago, I received a letter from LaFay, and he pointed me towards one very simple thing that if I could confirm would make for at least some sort of story, and that was that one of two witnesses in the case had recanted her testimony. So I drove out to Southwest Philly and met with Gloria Pittman, and she indeed recanted her testimony. So at that point, I started digging into the case, and it only took me a few days of reading through the file to realize that it was based on no solid evidence at all and police manipulation of a photo lineup and two witnesses who changed nearly everything about their timeline and their physical description of Gaskins to match one another as the trial approached.
Dan, take us back to that day and the circumstances that are known about Albert Dodson's murder.
So Albert Dodson was a drug dealer from Virginia, and he was up in Philadelphia to buy a large quantity of cocaine. His frozen body in February 1989 was found in an abandoned Mantua home. He had a gunshot wound to the face. He had a large amount of money in his coveralls, and that's all they had at that point. Gloria Pittman lived across the street. She told police that she was preparing to get high at the time. She had seen three men across the street laughing and talking, and then she heard what she thought was a gunshot. She told police very clearly, again and again, that she did not see the face of the man or men, depending on which account, running from the abandoned house after she heard the gunshot. When police brought her in for a formal interview, they showed her a photo lineup that included a photo of LaFay Gaskins. She did not identify it. She said that she did not see anyone's face. Police then asked her to look at a second set of photos. The only photo that she was shown twice in a row, apparently, was a photo of LaFay Gaskins. She then identified it. At the preliminary hearing, she again said she'd never seen Gaskins' face. Somehow, the case was still held for trial. Finally, in the trial, she again said that she had seen Gaskins' face and identified him.
There was a second witness as well.
The second witness was Edward Clyburn. Edward Clyburn was a self-described friend of Albert Dodson's. Judging by a court records matching his name and birth date, he had a number of run-ins with the law around on gambling charges. He was in possession of Albert Dodson's car after the murder and contacted the police once he found out that Dodson was dead. Initially, Clyburn's story was that he had met with Dodson this day, and they had met up with three drug dealers to buy, purportedly, I guess, to buy all of this cocaine. They had a bizarre, according to Clyburn, this bizarre drive around Philadelphia, ultimately ending up in Mantua. Clyburn said that he sensed it was a setup. Albert Dodson then left the car with two drug dealers. Initially, Clyburn told police this happened about 5 p.m., and that he waited about an hour for Dodson to return before leaving. Unfortunately, Gloria Pittman said that she heard the gunshots around noon or 1 that day. So, mysteriously, Clyburn's account changed from this all happening around 5 or 6 in the evening to it happening around noon or 1. perfectly lining up with Pittman's timeline.
Now, the victim, Albert Dodson, knew the alleged perpetrator, Lafay Gaskins. How was Gaskins pulled into this case?
The drug dealer who Albert Dodson was allegedly buying cocaine from was a man named Wayne Rodney Hampton, who goes by the name Junie. And Junie and Lafay Gaskins were close friends from North Philadelphia. There were allegations that Lafay Gaskins was Junie's bodyguard. Gaskins denies this. Gaskins fully admits that he was a drug dealer at the time as a young man in 1989.
I believe he was around 20 at the time.
Yes. And says, in fact, that they would go in to purchase drugs together, but had separate businesses selling them. It seems that that connection to Junie, who Albert Dodson was allegedly purchasing cocaine from to bring back to Virginia, is how police got interested in Gaskins. Another reason that police may have been interested in Gaskins, according to a police memo obtained by Gaskins, is that police appear to have believed that Lafay Gaskins was a member of the Junior Black Mafia. The Junior Black Mafia, for older listeners, as older listeners surely remember, was one of the most notorious and fearsome organized crime syndicates in Philadelphia. This memo, while police were looking for Gaskins, stated that Gaskins was on the board of Junior Black Mafia. Gaskins emphatically denies that he was a member of Junior Black Mafia. According to a law enforcement source who searched a law enforcement database on gang affiliations that includes prisoner gang affiliations, he's not listed as one of the many prisoners with the Junior Black Mafia affiliation. And further, this was never brought up at trial. And if they had any evidence that Gaskins was a member of Junior Black Mafia, it seems like most surely it would have been.
Dan, set this 1989 murder in the context of perceptions in Philadelphia and the nation at large about crime and drug dealing, and to what extent those perceptions might have influenced or led to the result of him being sentenced to life without parole.
Yeah, well, the context is important. It doesn't excuse the injustice that's been done to Lafay Gaskins, but it helps explain it, and that's important. Philadelphia, 1989 was an incredibly bloody year. 476 people recorded murdered that year. 500 people recorded murdered the next. This was a time of incredible citywide fear of crime of all sorts, and particularly of violent crime. There was a real public clamor for tough-on-crime legislation that prosecutors and politicians were happy to exploit to their own political ends. The result was a toxic brew of trials where defendants were not afforded the due process rights guaranteed in our prosecution, and a system of mass incarceration that incarcerates more people than any other nation on earth. So as we're looking back at how we got ourselves into the mess we're in today, we need to think about how very real public fears, like the ones that were felt in Philadelphia in 1989, can translate into really disastrous outcomes, both for society as a whole and for individuals like Lafay Gaskins.
Dan, you cite Seth Williams' role or lack thereof in getting Gaskins a new hearing. Has he had opportunity to read your report, or have you spoken to him directly on this matter?
Seth Williams' office refused to let me speak to Seth Williams about Lafay Gaskins' case. They provided me with a statement that more or less mocked Gaskins.
How so?
The statement, if I could pull it up briefly, basically said that he had tried and failed in various Post-Conviction Relief Act petitions, and that Gloria Pittman's recantation wasn't surprising, since recantations are common in long-running cases. And he also pointed to the fact that the Pennsylvania Innocence Project had turned down Gaskins' case. Well, that was a huge misunderstanding of why the Pennsylvania Innocence Project turned down LaFaye Gaskin's case. I spoke to Marissa Bluestein, the legal director of the Innocence Project, Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and she told me the Pennsylvania Innocence Project spent many months reviewing Mr. Gaskin's case. The attorneys who reviewed Mr. Gaskin's conviction had strong feelings he is likely innocent. There is no solid objective evidence that Mr. Gaskin's had any role in this murder. The reason Pennsylvania Innocence Project cannot take cases like this is because they are incredibly under-resourced and can only take cases that meet the incredibly high legal standard of actual innocence, which is nearly impossible in most cases.
We are brought up with the saying, you're innocent till proven guilty, but it seems to be quite the opposite once one is convicted. And indeed, you cite Rob Warden, executive director and co-founder of the Center on Wrongful Convictions, as saying simply undermining the evidence is not adequate to overturn the conviction.
Exactly. If you're unlucky enough to be a poor person, especially a poor young black man being railroaded for a crime that you didn't commit, if you don't have a good lawyer who's able and willing to poke holes in the prosecutor's case at the time of your original trial, and you're convicted, once that door is closed, it's incredibly hard to get out.
Are you still in touch with LaFaye Gaskin's?
Yes, I speak to him every week.
At this point, as a friend, confidant, or also still continuing to try to shed light on his case?
Well, I've certainly grown close to him over the last 2 years. Initially, as I was reporting the case, I certainly did my best to maintain my objectivity. But once one has determined that the person that they're in communication with is set to die in prison for a murder that they very, very, very likely did not commit, it's hard not to to have some personal sympathies get mixed in as well.
Dan, thanks so much for explaining this specific case and the general circumstances around it for our audience on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks very much for having me and for shining some light on this case.
Did LaFaye Gaskin's really murder Albert Dodson? The title of an article in the current Philadelphia magazine by investigative reporter Dan Denver.